This is The People's Game, Pacifica Radio's coverage of the 2010 World Cup, where we look at the games on the field as well as the political, economic, cultural, and social subtexts of the largest cultural event in the world, the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. I'm Alan Minsky. On today's show, Ziggy Marley joins The People's Game to tell about his experiences in South Africa, attending matches, playing a free concert for the people of Soweto, and reflecting on the Pan-African solidarity expressed at the Cup. And then we're joined by Matthew Futterman of the Wall Street Journal. He has an article about the great Dutch player and coach Johan Cruyff and his influence on both the Dutch and Spanish teams. And then we're joined by one of the busiest people in the world this past month, Sean Engel, the editor of the Guardian.co.uk sports webpage. I don't know if you've checked it out, but if you haven't, you're one of the few English language soccer fans in the world who's yet to visit it. It's unbelievable for the amount and quality of coverage. And we'll talk to Sean Engel about the website that he oversees. And lastly, we'll hear from Gustavo Arellano as he talks with our producer Fernando Romero and our co-host Jennifer Doyle about the People's Game and the 2010 World Cup. All that and more on The People's Game. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by Ziggy Marley. Ziggy Marley, in all likelihood, needs no introduction. He is a multiple Grammy-winning recording artist, and he is the leader of the band Ziggy Marley and the Melody Makers. Welcome to The People's Game, Ziggy Marley.
Yeah, thank you.
So you're just back from South Africa, where you attended the World Cup. Just start off and tell us what your experiences were like down in South Africa.
Yeah, we got there. And, you know, it was pretty cold when we got there. We went into Johannesburg. Then we traveled around a little bit. We were on motorcycles. We went up to a city called Bloemfontein, where we saw Nigeria and Greece. And then we went back to Johannesburg, where we saw Brazil and Ivory Coast. Then we went up to a city called Rustenburg, where we saw Ghana versus Australia. But, you know, before we went, we had a lot of, you know, a lot of people telling us, oh, be careful and all these type of things, how dangerous it was over there. But we had a good time, and, you know, all that danger talk, we didn't really experience any of that. We saw a lot of people from all over the world there having a really good time. So I think everybody was surprised by how cool over there is, you know.
If I'm correct, you play soccer, right? And you've played it your entire life.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're a big soccer fan?
Yeah, man, definitely.
What teams impressed you that you saw live?
Well, I was really impressed by Ghana. I thought, you know, I had them, before I even left for the World Cup, I was like, all right, African country is going to be in the finals. And so when we were there, the whole excitement with how far Ghana reached, you know, what happened to them was very, well, we were very upset with what happened at the end with the guy blocking the ball with his hands in the goal and all that type of thing. But, you know, Ghana was very impressive and represented Africa very well.
What did it mean to you to attend the first World Cup on the African continent?
Well, you know, Africa is a big deal to us. And, you know, I mean, my father took me to Africa for the first time when he went to Zimbabwe to celebrate the independence there. So from that day on, my mind was kind of opened up to Africa and the struggles of Africa from slavery to colonial days. And I started to, you know, to study more about Africa and the history of Africa, because when I used to go to school in Jamaica, they didn't really teach us much about Africa. And so that journey kind of made me open my eyes and made me start to learn a lot more about Africa and the struggle that was happening there.
You know, we've used a number of different songs as theme songs on this show, and the latest song we've been playing is Master Blaster by Stevie Wonder, which is both a song that celebrates your father's
life and work, and also mentions Zimbabwean independence in the song. And it's a beautiful song.
Yeah.
Were you able to sort of get off of the World Cup path and travel around South Africa away from the various venues?
The World Cup was only like a backdrop to what we were doing. Still, we were there riding on motorcycles around the countryside, doing some camping, meeting some people in the rural areas of South Africa. And also, the whole effort we had was trying to do a free concert, which we accomplished that. You know, it wasn't something that we had pre-planned, but we had hoped to do it. So while we were there, we were trying to find people who were willing to help us to get that done, and we did that in Soweto.
Wow.
Which was very significant for me. You know, I mean, Soweto was the name that I associated a lot with the struggle against apartheid. So we saw a lot of the countryside, and we actually did some riding on the freeways, which are very well built freeways, and people travel very fast on them. So it's kind of scary, you know, but we made it.
And how did the concert go? Tell us a little bit about the concert. That sounds amazing.
The concert was in Soweto. It was a free concert we did for the people there. It went well. You know, before we left, we tried to get some support from, you know, the corporate people over there and you know, the FIFA people and all these things. But it was impossible. So we went there with the determination that, well, we're going to get this done with or without that. And so we met people, and eventually we got some help from some corporate people who had this venue in Soweto where people went to watch games on big screens. And so we asked them to, you know, loan us the place so that we want to do this free concert there for the people in Soweto. And they agreed to that, and it was a good turnout. The police, they almost shut us down in the middle of the song because they said a lot of people were smoking marijuana and they were going to stop the show, but they didn't stop it, and so we continued. And it was very peaceful there. You know, I think my brother, who was with me, Ron, because they came up to him and said, we have to stop the show. The police is going to stop the show. Everybody's smoking marijuana. They're going to start locking up people. And he said, but look at the people. Everybody's peaceful. There's nobody who's making any trouble there, you know, so... But it all turned out very well for us there. The concert went well and people enjoyed it. It was the first time I was playing in South Africa, and I played a lot of my father music because I felt that was a good for me to represent him there. He would have been there, and his music is very powerful in Africa. So I did a lot of his music and a few of mine.
You know, I've seen, of course, footage of your father obviously playing music, but I've seen footage of him playing football, and he was a fantastic football player.
Yeah, man, he was a good football player.
And yourself, are you also...
I've played all through my school years. We won a few championships in high school with the team I was on there. I'm all right. I'm pretty good in the midfield.
And did you get to play at all in South Africa?
No, you know, well, I got an injury early. I had a knee operation earlier this year. Got injured playing soccer.
Ah.
So I wasn't up to it, you know, really. But I was so tempted, you know.
I got one or two more questions for you, but let me remind listeners that I'm speaking with Ziggy Marley here on The People's Game. And your music, your family's music, I very much associate with trying to elevate people's consciousness and at the same time to bring about an elevated global consciousness. Now, certainly the World Cup is probably the most popular cultural event, single cultural event in the world. Do you sense that the nature of what was transpiring in South Africa was elevating people's consciousness? Do you see the tournament working in that way in any sense?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a tournament, but I think it's people. I think the tournament bringing people together, but I don't think the tournament is actively out there. To what I saw, I don't see it actively doing anything with an agenda of like the world, and you know they're doing a soccer thing. They know the world is coming together, but I don't think they're active enough actually in terms of the cooperation that is FIFA and all of those involved. I think they could be much more active. But what I saw was people, because we joined lines going into the stadium for one of the games, and the people, I mean, African people are loving people, sharing people. So the vibe there was, and it didn't even matter which team, I mean, the Australians got a little rowdy in the games that we went to. But the host country and the people of the continent of Africa, they're so open-minded and so loving of all people that this is what we saw. But it's because of the people, it's not because of FIFA. It's because of people, you know. So it all depends, you know, how the host country and the people of that country are as people, and less on what FIFA or the World Cup is promoting, because you know, it's when you get down to it, is the normal people who are going into the stadium mixed in with everybody else, the opponent, and you know, you mix with the opponents and everybody, but there was still it was a celebration, you know.
I think the world was very impressed, and of course this is a part of the texture of your family's music. A sense not only just of globalism, but also of Pan-Africanism. And I think the world was extremely impressed with the way that the people of Africa got behind Ghana. And as I think most people in the world tracked the tournament, there was a real sense of disappointment that they didn't go forward. Because I do think that had Ghana gone into the semifinals against the Netherlands, which by all measure they sort of earned the right to, and then it didn't happen that way, it really would have been a beautiful expression of human solidarity.
Yeah, I mean, it was. Because the other thing that one of my purpose for going to Africa at this time and using the World Cup as a backdrop was to kind of remind people of the idea of African unity. You know, and we did that in the concert. I did that in the interviews that I did to let the people know that this opportunity that Africa has, is it goes beyond the World Cup. It goes beyond this event. It goes beyond winning and losing games. This opportunity is an opportunity, I think, that, for example, there was a lot of, I mean, this might be one of the only times that there were so many different people from so many parts of Africa in one place in Africa. So it was really a good opportunity to reignite the idea of African unity, which we did. But what I told people was that, you know, because we were all unified behind Ghana, but what I said, the good thing about it is that even in the loss, we were unified in that sorrow. And that is the big picture. It's not about winning or losing. It's about the unity. So even in losing, we were unified in the grief that we felt. And that's a good thing, you know, in the bigger picture of unity. You know, sometimes it takes losing to unify. Sometimes it takes winning. It doesn't matter what it takes. As long as we're unified, you know.
Sure, it is true. I mean, in some respects, it's a petty example, but if you look at the fan base of certain clubs like the Chicago Cubs in American baseball that are perennial losers, they have the most amount of solidarity, and it can really bond people. And
Yeah. So what the big thing was after it was, you know, who knows why? You know, maybe there was everything is for a reason, and, you know, we all felt that sorrow, and maybe that's what the lesson is, that we're unified anyway, you know?
Well, I definitely thought, and again, this is a political talk show about the World Cup. We talk about the games on the field and also the political, cultural subtext. I really felt that it was a clear exhibition, the way the unity occurred around Ghana, that the idea of Pan-Africanism is very alive.
Yeah, but the funny thing was that when all the other African countries got knocked out, this discussion did come up while I was there with people there, you know? And we were talking about, well, you know, how good it is that it is a good thing that there's only one African country in it, because that make everybody is behind one it kind of worked that way. So it was interesting that, you know, I mean, even though South Africa was out, Nigeria and Ivory Coast and Cameroon and these other countries, there was a reason why there was only one country that one African nation that made it through, so that everybody in Africa could be unified behind one idea then, you know, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So, you know, everything for a reason, I would say.
Yeah, and it was a great country, too, given the history of Ghana. It was a fantastic representative.
Yeah, it's the first African nation to gain independence, you know.
Hey, thank you so much for joining us on The People's Game. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you the one question that does stand out at this moment, which is what your thoughts might be about Holland versus Spain. Do you think one side looks better than the other?
It's a hard decision. I thought Germany was a good team, actually. I was on the plane coming back when I heard that Germany lost, so that was surprising. So it's unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
I like both countries. I'm a little edging towards Holland because they're cool, you know what I mean?
Yeah. they've carried some things that they've allowed people to do that they wanted to do
cool
for a long time, yeah. Well, Ziggy Marley, thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game.
Thank you, brother.
Everyone's feeling pretty. It's hot third. Even if they try, from the park hockey rhythm, Marley's hard to turn the boss. Tonight there will be a party.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by Matthew Futterman. He is a sports writer for The Wall Street Journal, and I've asked Matthew to join us because I saw his article yesterday following Spain's victory over Germany, and right on, I think he hit the nail right on the head. As I spoke about on yesterday's show, one of the key figures now, really the sort of most ascendant figure in global soccer in some respects, is Johan Cruyff. Johan Cruyff was, of course, one of the great players in the history of soccer, but what many people don't know is even from the beginning of his career, he was a tactician and a strategist, almost like a second coach on the teams he played for, and he was one of the people who developed what's called total football. Well, to fill in more of the picture, I'm joined by Matthew Futterman. Loved your article yesterday, Matthew. Welcome to The People's Game and from South Africa.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit more about what you wrote about yesterday in your article about this Dutchman in Catalonia has to be very happy.
Well, I would think so. And, I mean, a lot of what you see in the World Cup right now in international soccer is this tension and this conversation that goes on between in reference to trying to answer the question of, you know, can you play beautifully and win? It's certainly the kind of soccer that people love to watch, but it hasn't been all that successful the last, 10 or 15 years. There's, you know, teams have really loaded up on the defense and, goal scoring is down and, you have these few exceptions of teams that were under the Cruyff influence that play this very distinctive brand of the game.
Yeah, and in your article, again, it's called Validation for a Soccer Genius, and you can find it on the Wall Street Journal website. You talk about how Cruyff, played for Holland, of course, in the 70s. Then will be a lot of talk about these teams because they were the two teams that made the finals previously but didn't win in 74. He didn't play in 78, actually, in Argentina. A lot of controversy and rumor surrounds why, even to this day, even though he's tried to clarify what he said had happened and why he didn't attend, now contradicts what he said at the time. And he's something of a mysterious figure. But anyway, he went from Ajax of Amsterdam down to Barcelona as a player. And then in 1988, he became the coach of Barcelona. And he really introduced this sort of Dutch theory of total football to the side Barcelona, and the current Spanish team is made up largely, or a slight majority of the players on the field yesterday were from the squad Barcelona playing Cruyff soccer.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that not only do they embrace his brand of soccer, but he really embraced them too. You know, he was a real hater of Franco, the famous dictator who was, whose team was Real Madrid. And, you know, there was that long-running tension between the kind of soccer that Real Madrid played and the kind that Barcelona played. And what you really see is the Barcelona style of that quick pass in. He's really still one out in that league, and you know they're recognized now as the masters of the game, even though they didn't win the Champions League this year.
Right, and of course sometimes because Leo Messi plays on Barcelona, the role of Iniesta and Xavi, if you just see a sort of surface reporting on the team, there's a focus on Messi. But as you can see with the Spanish side, Iniesta and Xavi are the beautiful practitioners of total football.
They're really the heart and soul. They really seem to be the heart and soul of that Spanish team, yes.
And in contrast...
In addition to Puyol, of course, who really, even though he's not in the center, he really seems to be the anchor of that defense.
Right, and they have a number, of course, global superstars that are sort of now on the periphery of the club in terms of the role they play, like Thierry Henry and Marquez, the central back from Mexico, was their starting central defender only a couple years ago. Now he plays maybe every other match. And what do you make of the Dutch side? Because after all, total football is most associated with the Dutch, and yet it seems now the Spanish are the true practitioners.
Well, they still seem in the games that I've seen them play here, they still are playing a very heavy possession game. I mean, when you're watching the Dutch and you're not watching England. I mean, England is playing those long balls down the side, and just not play. Well, they seem to play a sort of low percentage game, and the Dutch still play a heavy percentage game. But when they go on the attack, they seem to do it a little bit differently, and they lose a little bit of their. Of what they're of that Cruyff influence, they and you can do that when you have a guy like Robin, Arjen Robben, who is just so deadly up front and can really create for himself.
Right. No, he definitely comes flashing in from the wings, and it does seem that they're if the theory of total football, sort of the first point, and there were a number of points as it developed as a sort of theory of football, was that every player on the field can play in any role. So defenders had offensive skills, midfielders could play either way, and people up front could also switch back and defend. And
they do a little. I would say they do. They're not doing it. And to their. To be truthful, Spain doesn't attack Spain doesn't attack with 11 men either. You haven't been seeing that. I mean,
right.
It's rare that you see too many of the defenders really head up to the front. Sergio Ramos has been doing it a lot the last couple games. But it's a little bit of total football light the way these guys are doing it right now. But it is still different than any other two teams in the tournament.
Right, and it should, but it'll be interesting to see how they meet then, because a lot of times there's been expectations in this tournament that we're going to get beautiful free-flowing games, and certainly Germany, for the most part, sort of did sit back and didn't, I don't know that they were able to really unleash their flowing offense against Spain. Spain had such domination of ball control and sort of confidence on the ball, even if the Germans in the end statistically ended up with a high percentage of possession. You didn't really get a sense that they were ever really in their game, that the Spaniards had disrupted.
You didn't get to see. I mean, part of it. It's funny, and I'll do the blasphemous thing of an American sports fan. It sort of reminded me a little bit of the Giants Bills Super Bowl back in 1991, where the Giants' game plan was essentially, well, we're going against this high-powered team. They can't score if they don't get the ball. And they had, I think the Giants had the ball for about 40 minutes during that game.
Yeah, O.J. Anderson.
And that's what it reminded me of watching the game last night in Durban when I was there. They just wasn't going to let Germany, this team that was scoring seemingly scoring four goals a game, even though it was only 2.6, they just weren't going to let them have the ball.
But there was no Scott Norwood tragedy at the end of the matches. Spain won a little bit more convincingly than the Giants did.
No major tragedy. No.
Well, Matthew Futterman, as an American sports journalist in South Africa, let me just throw the most general question. What's it been like down there for you?
It's been an interesting experience. I mean, it's my first World Cup, and it's a different sort of World Cup from what I gathered from the other reporters than you would get in a place like Germany or in France. A lot of that has to do with the personal security issues. You don't have the game sort of spilling out into the streets, into outdoor, all day, all night festivals the way it does, the way they do in what I've heard they do in Europe. And essentially that's what happened at the Olympics in Vancouver and often happens in big international sporting events.
Right.
So you can't really have that because of a lot of the security issues. And so it's been, but having said that, a lot of people were skeptical that Africa could pull this off, and they seem to have. So far, they think they got two games to go, and it looks like they're gonna pull it off.
What's your from where you're sitting? Do you have a clear sense that you're in the center of the world right now? Because as far as I can tell, it's not just the United States. The amount of global attention on this spectacle has exceeded all other sporting spectacles. What's your sense of that from where you sit?
You know, you do feel like everybody here is paying attention to it, and I get that sense that I'm in the center of things when I call home to my wife, who is not much of a sports fan, but is a popular culture fan, and she knows what's going on. So if she knows, if they're getting through to my wife, then everybody is paying attention. And, that's my measuring stick.
Yeah, no. In Los Angeles, I can tell you that no sporting event in recent memory has produced the number of sort of mass party viewings and packed houses at bars and pubs that this has. So, you know, for some reason, this is, even in the United States, the sort of communal aspect of it has sort of rubbed off. It was, of course, huge when USA was in it, and in Southern California when Mexico was in it. And Korea, by the way, there's a huge Korean community in Southern California that gathered out publicly to watch the matches. But, you know, this has been going on since those teams were eliminated in the second round. What was your sense, I suppose, going back to Team USA and how Team USA played in South Africa? I mean, after all, they did lose to Ghana. Here it was, of course, you know, the big story and everybody focused on Team USA. But was the sentiment when they faced Ghana in South Africa highly for Ghana? And how was Team USA received in general?
I mean, I think they were received as having some of the biggest hearts in the tournament, if not the biggest. And they were the team that nobody really wanted to play, because the one thing you knew, I would say them in Uruguay, because the one thing you knew was that the U.S. was going to come after you for 90 minutes. There was no quitting them. And you know what? A lot of the European, a lot of Latin American teams, they get down by a goal, get down by two goals. They kind of seem to go through the motions for the last 30, 45 minutes. You never saw that with the U.S. Having said that, I think they played about as well as they could play given the athletes they have. I know people thought, oh, how could they not beat Ghana? It's an African country, 24 million people. You looked at the Ghana team after that game, they're bigger, faster, and stronger than the U.S. and more talented on the ball. That seemed to be a very obvious thing to me. And I saw Ghana play three or four times during this tournament. And they're a penalty kick away from being a semifinal team, too. So I know a lot of people were disappointed. I know the U.S. team felt like they could have won. That was a winnable game, and it was a winnable game. But I think at the end of the day, they ultimately lost to a better team.
Are you going to be able to attend the final in person?
Yeah, I'll be at the final, sure.
Who do you think is going to take that?
You know, I would say that my heart says the Dutch and my brain says Spain.
I think I'm actually...
The Dutch have sort of a small country in this, and have that snake-bitten history, and, you know, it would be a wonderful story if, you know, the Netherlands could win that. But Spain seems to be some kind of machine. They seem to have that... Germanic mentality of just knowing and what the Italians used to have, just knowing exactly how much they have to do to win at this point.
Yes, indeed. Well, Matthew Futterman, thank you so much. And I, again, really want to encourage people to check out his article you can find on the Wall Street Journal website called Validation for a Soccer Genius, Johan Cruyff Helped Build the Dutch and Spanish Teams. That's by Matthew Futterman from the Wall Street Journal. Matthew, thank you for joining us here on The People's Game.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm an elitist. I want to drive a car. And I want to park a car.
Because a plane crash is spectacular.
That's right. Plane crash is spectacular.
And it's always news when something goes wrong with a plane. A sweet tamale containing raisins and pineapple. I never had one of those.
Stinking, smelly, illegal aliens and poor people.
KPFK FM 90.7 in Orange, Riverside, San Diego, San Bernardino, and Los Angeles counties, 98.7 KPFK in Santa Barbara, also on the FM dial, and all around this insane world at kpfk.org. I'm your host, Gustavo Ariano, staff writer with the OC Weekly, author of the column Ask a Mexican. Again, find me on Facebook, be my fan, type in Ask a Mexican, get the bandito, used for stereotypical, satirical purposes, mind you, and Be My Fan. And of course, now, after many, many weeks of not doing it, the John and Ken moment of hate with my producer, Fernando. So, Fernando, what are those fools talking about this week?
Well, today's John and Ken moment of hate that come to us from June 14th, is a couple of days after the World Cup started.
Okay.
And they were talking specifically about the Mexican national team and about just... John really hates soccer, actually. John just hates it. Ken's a little... He probably hates it, too, but not as much. But, yeah, this clip just talks about how, you know... Well, take a listen. We'll
roll it, as they say.
Oh, yeah. And he really sounds stupid.
Are you watching the exciting World Cup? By the way, another listener sent this little blog report, which I wasn't aware of, and it's a hoot. Get ready. The Home Depot sponsors Mexico, but not the U.S.
In the Home World Depot Cup. Is sponsoring the Mexican team?
Yes, they are. They are one of the sponsors of Team Mexico, but apparently they do not support any money, dollars, for the U.S. team.
Well, there you go. I guess that's their customer base, or just Mexicans showing up now at Home Depot?
Maybe the U.S. team already had enough money and the Mexican team didn't, and they felt sorry for them.
It was an act of compassion.
Yeah.
No, maybe they're very popular with the people from Mexico, thanks to the day laborer movement and everything else.
All the construction workers.
That's an outright lie. In the studio with me also, Jennifer Doyle from A Left Wing, the amazing blogger, and when she has time, she's a professor at UC Riverside. But doesn't the U.S. national team train at the Home Depot Center in Carson?
Yeah, I don't know where they're getting their information or what they're talking about.
Well, not only that, but Terry Ray Romer says that maybe Mexico. I'm pretty sure that the Mexican Football Federation has more money than the American Federation.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure that they don't need money from anybody. And what this Home Depot, it's essentially it's ad revenue. It's not a sponsor. It's not like you're.
Yeah.
It's not like a charity or anything like that. It's actually like ad revenue. So
there were a million and one things wrong with that that clip. That was just, I wish I could say that it was totally anomalous and that they were two isolated lunatics in some far corner of some parking lot ranting, but sadly they actually represent a coherent group of haters out there.
The top rated talk show in Southern California and has been that for a good decade, and every week we expose their lunacy and idiocy. And of course, this is a perfect segue, though, and I actually asked Fernando. Usually Fernando just digs through the archives and gets up gems, and this was a great gem, but I asked him specifically to focus on soccer because we are in the World Cup. We do have the final, and I asked Fernando to be here. He's going to be a guest with me throughout the show, and also Jennifer, because they are also involved with a great podcast that KPFK has done throughout the World Cup, which is called The People's Game. And what's the website, either of you?
It's thepeoplesgame.org.
Thepeoplesgame.org, that simple. And created by my Svengali Alan Minsky. An amazing, amazing podcast. And go to thepeoplesgame.org. I know we're almost toward the end, but this is really the best soccer coverage here in California going on right now. If not the United States, and of course, from a progressive perspective. So I have, before we talk about the Cup, and this is just going to be a general discussion of what has happened, the different stories, especially Jennifer has been doing a lot of great stuff on her own blog. Talk about the People's Game. What can people expect on both on the website, all of that?
On the website, you can go on and we have archived every show that we've done since the start of the World Cup, actually even before the World Cup started. The show is essentially, it's imbued with a lot of the social and political subtext of each team playing in the tournament. And we've spoken with people all around the world, people in South Africa, people in Ghana, people in Italy, people in all over the world, people representing or correspondents from every country representing the World Cup. And what we try to do was just have people come on and, you know, just tell their story of what that country represents for their people.
Yeah, you'll find some pretty cogent game analysis as well. And on the website, there are little maps which explain narratives, which explain what you're going to hear. So I think if you're readying for this weekend, you can actually go and pick out podcasts that talk about Total Football, for example, podcasts where you have Tony Procedo, who's been one of our regular commentators, who's a supporter of Spain and a goalkeeper himself, providing some good technical commentary about players. But you'll also find a sort of black helicopter rants about the evils of FIFA, some in-depth discussion of the political and economic issues around FIFA's relationship to host countries like South Africa. So it's a boot camp course basically on the cultural politics and economics and history behind the World Cup.
This is something that you wouldn't get anywhere else. I've never heard of a show or seen of a show that's exactly like this. That you won't find this kind of thing in ESPN or ESPN Deportes. This is very unique to, talk about the political and social subjects of each country.
And there's a feminist on board, too.
Exactly.
That makes us
there's two of them.
Hardcore
feminist. In fact, probably the only other entity in the country that would offer such an analysis is the great progressive columnist Dave Zirin. That honestly would be it. So folks,
and he's been on the show.
Of course, Zirin. So folks, please, if you love soccer, you'll love this podcast. And if you have no clue whatsoever about soccer, after hearing even one podcast, you'll love soccer and all the ramifications. Go to thepeoplesgame.org. Thepeoplesgame.org. But now let's talk about what has happened in this cup. So this Sunday, you have Netherlands versus Spain in the final, each of them reaching the World Cup final for the first time in their history. Spain for the first time ever. Netherlands has been there a couple of times. Neither has won it. It's almost unprecedented that you have a country that has never won the World Cup winning the World Cup. It's going to be watched by, what's the estimates of the audience for this Sunday?
Oh, they're mind-boggling numbers, and I feel a little bit put on the spot, but I have no idea.
1.8 billion,
it's the
humongous.
Most watched event in media. It is the largest global spectacle that exists. It's astonishing, and it's one of the exciting things about participating in it. I think is actually feeling yourself to be a part of a global audience.
On this Sunday, I'm pretty sure for 90 minutes the whole world will stop. And around 2 billion seems about right. But you also don't count people at pubs and people watching it online and streaming it online. So I mean, and we were talking about this on the show how specifically this World Cup is probably the most watched because everything just of the media and the technology that we have now compared to even 2002 or 1998.
Even 2006 for that matter.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
since 2006, we've had the true advent of Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. I mean, those entities were around back then, but now they weren't so integral. And then, of course, ESPN popped out with ESPN3 that allowed people to stream the broadcast live. And you've had the upgrading of technology.
Yeah, Twitter, actually, if I remember right, I think that dates to 2007, 2008. So I've been I'm a real fan of Twitter as a way to experience and amplify and enrich in your experiences of the games by getting in contact with really good journalists who are there watching the game. You get such wonderful perspectives. I've been watching the games with Supriya Nair, who's based in Mumbai, one of the best tweeters I know. And
what's her handle?
It's Supriya N is her Twitter address. So
awesome.
Supriyan. So check it out because she is absolutely hilarious. She's in a thing where she actually rewrites lines of English romantic poetry, for example, to kind of accommodate what's going on in the field. Things like that that you pretty much won't find anywhere but on something like Twitter, on new media forums. So I should say this is one of the reasons why this kind of expanded media access to the game. It's one of the reasons why there have been so many controversies around the game because we're actually technically able to see more on the field. We're able to see bad offside calls. Mm-hmm. We're able to see goals that were scored but not awarded. We're able to see fouls. There are more cameras trained on the match. There's just more technology put in the service of experiencing the match. And so we, as viewers, we see way more than these referees do because, of course, they're not allowed to actually look at replay. And so they're making their calls on what they see with their own eyes. So that's been one of the interesting stories about this World Cup.
This is the first time the World Cup has been held in Africa. There's been so many political stories behind them. I mean, it would take really, again, a whole series of podcasts. So tune into the People's Game, thepeoplesgame.org. I want to start, though, the discussion at the very, very beginning, because Jennifer had this great blog post about it, about the theme song to the World Cup. Shakira did this concert with, debuting her the theme song to the World Cup. It's called Waka Waka, not to be mistaken with Fozzie's chuckle from the Muppet Show. But so you have a world seeing it like, oh, wow, this is a really great song. But immediately, bloggers, soccer bloggers, African bloggers, music bloggers, they went up in arms. Why did they go crazy?
Went up in arms because this song, Waka Waka, this time for Africa, which is one of the official anthems of the World Cup, uses directly in its chorus, Zangalewa, which is started as a song, it was a political song from Cameroon that was incorporated into a pop hit by the Cameroonian musicians Golden Sounds, and that song was a big hit in the 80s, and many Cameroonians can actually sing you that song. It's not an unknown song. It's not an obscure folk song on some, you know, bit of vinyl in somebody's back closet.
Not like The Lion Sleeps Tonight, that horrible story.
There's a story behind that one too. But they lifted it without acknowledging the use of this song whatsoever. Not at all. Like, it would be one thing if it were acknowledged, but it's completely unacknowledged. So it's the beauty of the internet was that this Cameroonian musicians, people who are fans of African pop music were all over this within a minute. There were, some of people who are working in Latino music, some of those blogs were actually on the leading edge of paying attention to this issue. And they pointed out actually that this song, the Cameroonian song, was playing in Colombian discos. And so they speculate this may be one of the reasons, the ways in which this got kind of
interesting. Fernando, why do you think Shakira and FIFA, for that matter, thought that they could so blatantly rip off this original song? Because you hear it, you go to YouTube and you hear Shakira's song, and then you hear the original Cameroonian one. It's worse than George Harrison singing My Sweet Lord and claiming that he didn't hear the chiffons, He's So Fine. Where do you think they come off doing that?
Well, obviously it was just a marketing technique. I mean, you have Shakira, one of the biggest, mega stars in the country. You know, I mean, 98 had Ricky Martin, 2010 they have Shakira. So I'm guessing that's what it was. You know, they need a huge mega star. Like, hey, we need you to perform this song. And FIFA's basically, when you get down to it, it's all just about money. And
let's not forget Sony Music is involved. They have a pretty heavy hand in this. You know, and I should say this is part of a long tradition, and this is something that's been pointed out by people who are writing on the cultural politics around the World Cup and the way that African culture circulates. It's a long history of, in essence, the theft of the work of African musicians by European and American artists, and this appropriation and circulation within pop music. The Lion Sleeps Tonight actually is another story of this. That song was originally written by an African musician who sold
by
it for
Zulu,
pennies.
Yeah.
And that became the source, the heart of a lawsuit against Disney, which incorporated that song into The Lion King and made millions and millions off of it. So, you know, embedded within Waka Waka is a deeper history, right, of basically ripping off the continent.
Absolutely. I'm speaking to my producer, Fernando, and Jennifer Doyle. Jennifer Doyle writes the blog From a Left Wing, fromaleftwing.blogspot.com, and they are both involved in a podcast that KPFK does called The People's Game, thepeoplesgame.org. We are talking about the FIFA World Cup. The finale, the grand finale, is going to be this Sunday. What time?
It should be 11:30.
Yeah,
11:30. 11:30 morning. Pacific Standard Time.
Kickoff starts at 11:30.
Fernando and I are going on like a biological clock now that is like totally tuned into broadcasts of matches where you just sort of you wake up at 4 in the
exactly.
morning.
Exactly.
You're sort of.
Yes, watching all the games. So again, go to thepeoplesgame.org, KPFK's podcast on the World Cup. It has been going on ever since the beginning, if not even before the beginning, going all the way through. And we're talking about, again, soccer. You want to make a point?
I just wanted to point to my blog because I have an article about this. It's called Listening to the World Cup. And then I've written a longer article about this, which will be up in a couple of days for a journal called Social Text. And I talk about the Kanaan song, Wave and Flag, which is the Coca-Cola official anthem, and which is, of course, the lyrics have been heavily edited from the original, which is a very political song and a really interesting one. So I think it's a great topic, actually, the stuff that we hear around the World Cup and that we don't hear.
Another story that has sparked my interest politically is all the attention that both the American media and even the German media has been giving to the German soccer squad, because the German soccer squad, unlike times past, now it's heavily multi-ethnic. It's, I think, half of the team are children of immigrants or immigrants themselves. So and then Jennifer, again, did another blog post about how the New York Times did – I forgot to put it on your comment, but it was this ridiculous post talking about Germany and how they somehow superseded this theory of the big man that Africa still subscribes to. Talk to us about it.
I was really there repeating the insights of Supriya Nair, whom I just mentioned. Treason, Stratagems, and Spoils is the name of her blog. And she has a fantastic piece on there, which really inspired me, which is pointing up the ways in which liberal journalists who often really don't actually pay attention to something like, you know, a sport until something like this comes up, are really eager to see in the figure of, for example, Mesut Ozil, who's a Turkish-German player and a fantastic player. And I don't want to take anything away from him, partly because he looks exactly like Johnny Weir, who's one of my favorite athletes. But that's that aside, they're ready to see in his story, meaning the incorporation of a young man of immigrant background into the national side of a country which has a terrible, horrendous record in terms of the treatment of
the Turkish
workers and their children. It's just absolutely awful. And people are so ready to read in this story of redemption, as if, right, if Germany wins the World Cup or they have a great run, then somehow things in Germany must be better.
That was the same narrative that we had in 1998 World Cup, Fernando, with a French soccer squad with Zinedine Zidane. Want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's specifically the French national team is just filled with a lot of Algerian immigrants, Moroccan immigrants, and it was just as we all know, there's been a lot of tension, a lot of racial tension in Paris and throughout France. And it is perceived that, like Jennifer said, that because, you know, this national team that has a really great run and, you know, they incorporate all these teams of different ethnicities and different backgrounds, that it's all, you know, nice and dandy out there, which a lot of times it's not the truth.
If you want to join the conversation with the FIFA World Cup, with soccer, with the politics and all that, please call in to our intern, Cassandra, co-producer, actually, I call her, 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. What have been your favorite matches? Where are you going for? Are you going for Netherlands or Spain this Sunday? Any interesting stories? Are you a Tri fan or just upset beyond belief at the horrible calls that went our way? Are you a Donovan fan, or do you hate Landon Donovan? Many, many stories to talk about, FIFA. I just got a note from Alan Minsky, my Svengali, that the 2006 Cup, this is 2006, not this year, had a cumulative audience of 26.29 billion people. That's in the entirety of the Cup. That's how many people sigh. I mean, of course, the planet only has about 6 billion people, but again and again and again, this is soccer religion. Even before we go to the phone calls, let's actually talk about the game that's going to happen this Sunday. Fernando is wearing the bright, the traffic cone orange colors of the Netherlands soccer team. Obviously, I know who he's going for. We'll leave him for after what Jennifer says. Jennifer, who are you going for this Sunday? España, why?
I wore their kit last night. I played in a pickup game. Nice. I was head to toes in the colors of Spain. So I'm actually the kind of fan who's not actually an intense supporter of particular teams. There were about four teams I was interested in, and they were all out. So, but I have to say I am a Barca fan, and it is pretty much the same as rooting for Barca. So, I think that is more or less enough for me for this final. I'm going to say I feel like I'm in the afterburn of a love affair, and that this weekend is like the last legs of a summer romance. So I'm committed to having a good time while it lasts, but I think when Ghana left, that was the last of my teams that was still alive. I was like, well, I'm in it for the good time, ultimately this didn't really work out for me.
Well, we'll talk about Ghana and how they lost. All I'll say right now is Uruguay deserves whatever bad things come their way. they deserve a war of three, the war of the triple alliance on them. On soccer, only on soccer, of course. Fernando, you're a Mexican. Why do you like the Netherlands so much? And 1 minute before we go on a break.
Okay, total football. They invented this style of this tactic. If you're not really known in what total football is, it's a tactic wherein players switch positions off and on. You have a defender playing forward. They came up with this strategy about 30 years ago in the World Cup 1974, which is by far the greatest team in soccer history that never won the World Cup. And ever since that, you know, when I heard about that, I wanted to like look into that. And through that, I think I became Dutch at heart, just because of their culture and the way they play ball. And
wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. We'll get to your phone calls after this short break. Sans the subversive historian, alas. In in honor of the English soccer squad that had a horrendous run for the cup, we offer... it kind of sounds like Handel. It's not Handel. Dvorak, I'm so out of it. I like Dvorak, too, but those horns, they remind me a lot of Handel, of water music. I am Gustavo Ariano, but reminding you that at 4 p.m., right after me, in 20 minutes, on The Insiders with Maria Armudian, the Merchants of Doubt, industry scientists who have obscured the real science on everything from tobacco smoke to global warming, how coyote capitalism fuels global immigration, what to expect with the new healthcare law at 4 p.m. Maria Armudian at 4 p.m. Also, the verdict in the Oscar Grant case, the tragic murder of an unarmed man will be announced actually any moment, and we'll I'll say it the minute I find out. But in the meanwhile, we're going to talk about soccer. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. There was an article in some, I'm sorry, but I read right-wing rags all the time. You have to. But there was an interesting article, I think this was in The Atlantic, in the soccer blog, saying how Matt Drudge, the ultimate conservative whack job blogger and also one of the most read websites in the world, he has been having the World Cup on his front page every single day. So this blogger's argument was that American football, soccer, has finally reached the United States because you have even somebody like Drudge following it so closely. Do you buy that argument, Jennifer? Has soccer finally made it into the United States as a legitimate sport? As a quote-unquote legitimate sport.
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think that there's a certain kind of a myth. There's an endless reproduction of the myth that soccer that Americans don't care about soccer. Americans aren't interested in soccer. They maybe take an interest only around the World Cup. But again, it's that word, the way people define that word Americans, which excludes, especially in this region, the millions and millions of people who play and watch the sport. So I always have a bone to pick with narratives about the kind of anxious hand-wringing around when will soccer become popular. And I'm like, well, when will the organizations that run the U.S. Soccer Federation, for example, and mainstream sports media pay attention to the people who are already invested in the game and have been for generations, right? This isn't just like a couple years ago. We're talking about, you know, people in Los Angeles who are in their 30s whose dads were playing in leagues in Los Angeles. You know, this has been a major part of Southern California culture, of culture in the Southwest for years. And it's that fact is continually erased by Anglo media in particular. So, yes, but again, I sort of want to put a different spin on the narrative.
Fernando?
You were right on point, I think. I guess it is that definition of what's American, what isn't American. And a lot of times with my perception that I've had growing up as, you know, playing soccer as I was little, it was always perceived that, you know, that soccer was, you know, for immigrants or for foreigners or, you know, sons of immigrants, which, you know, that's basically defining me. And, you know, it's basically that definition that, you know, if you're in this side of the spectrum, you're the right on the left. If, this is my definition of American, then if you play soccer because you gotta be this, so you're not obviously American.
Well, I mean, the operating story about soccer, even within the kind of conservative narrative of this, is that it's the sport for immigrants, children, and women. Now, we can only...
And gays, I forget.
Right, and gays, right. Uh-huh. So who are taken interest in it as sort of like a demonstration of having some kind of fascination with Europe. You know, that's a pretty big part of the country. That's, women, children, and immigrants. And when we talk
that's
about
more
that,
than
as
half.
If,
that's at least 70% of the people.
I mean, just even within that sort of, which is a misrepresentation, but even within that, that says a lot about the ideology of that narrative, that these would be considered completely insignificant, bodies of people.
818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. If you want to talk about World Cup, about soccer, about the politics, about all those things, again, a plug for the podcast that both Fernando and Jennifer Doyle of UC Riverside contribute to. It's called The People's Game, thepeoplesgame.org. Nima in Woodland Hills, your questions or comments about the World Cup.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hi. A couple of comments. First of all, I just read an article by David Zirin in The Progressive, which was a very interesting article in regards to the construction of this massive stadium and just different aspects of it. For example, using the water usage while there is a water shortage as far as the construction, the technology, and how sort of the South Africans are looking for just a basic shelter and so forth. But I guess then that's true about Daigle Center too.
Yeah, well, you know, that's always been the thank you for your comment, Nima. That's always been one of the great conundrums of rooting for an event like the FIFA World Cup. There has been millions upon millions of hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, spent by the South African government to create stadiums that probably will not be used by the population at large. And Zaire, and I'm sure we all here have those struggles of, at the same time, definitely calling out those stories, but there's also something happening on the field that is indescribable.
There's actually a site called World Cup Watch, which is written by South African journalists, and that's worth seeking them out on the internet, because you have a lot of stories there from people who are on the ground reporting about activism and resistance to labor issues around the stadiums. I really recommend it. It is one of the big stories. And Gustavo, you're right. A lot of FIFA requires that in a host country for a World Cup build stadiums. Each stadium has to have a capacity of at least 70,000. Now, soccer is not actually the number one major central sport, established sport within South Africa. It has a great history. Enormous numbers of people play it, but it has a historical association with, of course, the disempowered black population. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And while it is very popular, the stadiums tend to be, you know, smaller. Crowds tend to be smaller. They're a little bit analogous to here, just a little, you know, not much bigger. But in terms of scale, it's not entirely different in terms of, say, for example, our own stadium in Los Angeles, the Home Depot Center. And so there's a big question about, you know, when the World Cup is over, you know, what are people going to do with these 70,000 capacity stadiums that were built expressly for the sport? There's really not. They'll never be used like this.
Fernando,
you touched on a good point. It's the same thing that happened in Japan and Korea in 2002. Yeah. They built all these really huge stadiums, which are now basically empty. They've been empty for the last 8 years. And people in South Africa have a right to be up in arms, because, you know, all that money that was spent, and, you know, you have the South African Football Federation or South African government saying, you know, oh, this is going to create jobs. Well, what's going to happen when the World Cup ends? Did it really create or generate a lot of money that was brought into the country? And I'm always at loss of words in regards to that kind of thing. If you build it, they will come kind of thing, because a lot of times it doesn't happen that way. And as I've been seeing the coverage on ESPN Deportes, you will see, you see the backdrop of the stadiums, and it's just like this, like, in a lot of times it's just like an impoverished land.
Yeah.
And like,
one of the stadiums is built across the street from an existing stadium. That stadium was about 20,000 seats shy, I think, of the 70,000 that FIFA required. And the circumstances were such that the organizations in South Africa decided to build this entirely new stadium across the street from a usable, decent
outlandish
stadium. It's really crazy.
Outlandish.
It's really crazy.
Maida in Anaheim, who are you going to be rooting for this Sunday?
I'm rooting for Spain, of course.
Por qué? Why?
Well, the U.S. and Mexico got eliminated, unfortunately, but I have friends in Spain, so I guess after my teams, I choose the one that I have some kind of relation to. But if Holland wins, I'll be okay with that. But but I'm hopefully Spain wins.
What have been your thoughts so far on the Cup? Have you enjoyed the Cup? I mean, besides the fact that I think all of our teams lost, besides that, do you think it's been a well-played Cup?
You know what? I think there's been a lot of controversy with the calls that the referees have made, and especially since FIFA is very strict on, you know, changing their ways about replays and whatnot. I think that's been kind of tough, but the excitement-wise, I think it's been really cool. I've actually worn different jerseys every day, so
cool.
It's exciting. Yeah.
Thanks for your call, Maida.
Okay, no problem. Bye.
Maida brings up a great point in terms of the officiating. I noted some xenophobia in the officiating. You had, of course, there was a soccer game between the United States and Slovenia, right?
Mm-hmm.
You had United States and Slovenia where there was a botched goal, and then afterwards, Landon Donovan, the star of the United States soccer team, a man who has had long experiences with Mexicans, being that he grew up here in Southern California, he started going off and saying, oh, well, the referee didn't really know that much English. You didn't know that?
No.
This is a referee from Mali. Saying, well, we were trying to communicate with him, but he didn't really speak the best English. And then recently, I saw this off of LA Times reporter Hector Tobar, his Facebook. I guess there was an ESPN announcer or somebody, but made an insult about a referee from Guatemala, saying, well, what do we expect from referees from Guatemalans? Share your thoughts or opinions, starting with Fernando.
There have been some really bad calls, throughout the tournament, that's for sure. I do remember when the Mali referee made that bad call.
And it was a horrible call.
It was a horrible call, but a lot of, I mean, I saw a lot of the coverage or the slack that he was getting on, especially on the online media. Like, I would go to Yahoo Sports or whatever it was, and he, I mean, he would be, it reminded me of when the O.J. Simpson trial, or that cover, I think
from
it was
Time Magazine where they darkened his black skin.
Yeah, that's what it reminded me of. I'm like, because he was just like, he was demonized, I mean, beyond, I mean, reproach. I mean, but.
Yeah. It's been really grim, a really dark side of the game, pardon for the choice of word, but it's just been a place where we see, it's like two things. One of the things is you're just seeing the obvious racism of the sports commentators. Oh, yeah. It's just like this kind of lazy way, you know, relying upon, you know, prejudice to, as if that provides some kind of, you know, intelligence.
Or cover.
Right. It's just terrible.
Eric Winata does that a
lot. Know, I mean, it's just really terrible. And the remark made about the Guatemalan referee was actually embedded within a larger kind of diss on CONCACAF, on the whole region, mm-hmm. in
all
essence.
All of Latin America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically. And, it's really shameful. They've been, not huge numbers of these, but they've been significant, often in very dramatic games, and unmistakable.
Yeah. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. If you have questions or comments about the FIFA World Cup, who are you rooting for this Sunday? Have you ever seen a soccer match? Have you even seen the World Cup? Mark in Santa Monica, your question or comment about football. Mark? Are you there, Mark? You're not there anymore. Maybe you could get to you. Tom in Malibu. This is actually a very good question for some of the folks out there. Tom, what's your question?
I actually was referring to an article I recently read in which they talked about why soccer is called soccer.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to talk about it. There's always been a source of confusion for many people, and many ignorant people are always telling me, why are you calling it soccer? And I think it's interesting to note that soccer is actually an English term.
Yes. It comes from England. It comes from association football, if I remember right.
Yes. Do you remember the name of the game is it's football association. That's the name of there's different types of football. There's rugby football, and the type of game that we're talking about, the World Cup, is called football association, which is taken from associations, so they call it soccer, and it's taken from that word specifically.
So soccer is basically a mixed acronym or abbreviation, if you will, of the full name of football.
Yeah, and so we've actually kept on a term that is truer to the roots of the game.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, have you been seeing the Cup, Tom?
Yeah, the way I'd like to describe it, though, is before I read that article with friends, was, look, there's rugby, it's called football. You have Australian rules football. There's Gaelic football, which has nothing to do with any of the above. And there's American football. So even in Italy, they call it calcio, not even football. So football's really a phylum, if you will. And then the species are like American football or soccer.
That's a really great way of bringing it down,
man. And can I just point out, the U.S. women's national football as a gridiron team, I don't know if they're actually associated with any national, like, official body, but they're representing the United States in an international competition of gridiron football, and they, of course, they cleaned up, they won. So congratulations nice. To the U.S. women gridiron football players out there.
Yeah. Carlos and Carson, your questions or comments about soccer or football or whatever you want to call it. Tachio.
Well, listen, I've been following soccer since I was a kid in Mexico back in the 50s. I'm an avid fan, but unfortunately, through the years, I've noticed that there is a very dark side to sports.
Yeah.
Not just soccer, but particularly soccer. Dirty politics and financial matters get deeply integrated into the sport. Look, South Africa is going to, with all the loans probably made by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank for this event, they're going to get stuck with it. And I believe one of the reasons why FIFA plays along with all these bankers, all these banking institutions, where they pick South Africa is because they know eventually they're not going to be able to pay back, and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank are going to go in there like vultures and take over all the resources of these poor countries, just like they do all over the world.
Definitely.
In Africa.
Thanks for your call. Sorry, Carlos. I want to get in a couple more calls before that. But it does, again, bring up a great point that we face here in the United States when it comes to our professional sports teams, where you have these public subsidies of massive stadiums are trying to lure franchises into a market, and then the taxpayers are stuck with the bill.
Yeah, I want to encourage people who feel this way, and they feel that if this is so polluting your relationship to the game, get involved with your local amateur squads, the semi-pro leagues that are playing in the area, and women's sports. There is basically no money there. So if you want a really, it's kind of sincere and relatively uncomplicated access to the pleasures of the game. Pally Blues, for example, is one of the best women's teams, soccer teams in the country, and they're playing at Pacific Palisades High School. Educate yourself about this side of sports, because it's one where you really don't have to deal with things like what he was just describing.
Even the late great John Wooden, and the one of the few true accepted saints of sports, toward the end of his life, he said, "I love women's basketball more than the men's game. It's more fundamentally sound. It's more exciting, and you don't have those egos and that nastiness." Really quickly, I just want to apologize to Naida, who I called Maida. She's a friend on Facebook, and she left a comment saying, "Dude, it was me talking to you on the radio." That makes you sound even more OC, Naida. But hey, we got to rock it. Fernando, really quickly.
I think about the former president George W. Bush, how he got rich. He was the owner of the
Texas Rangers.
Owner. And you have specifically this very conservative group of who owned the Rangers, who decided, we're gonna build a new stadium. You know what? We're gonna tax you guys, the taxpayers. I'm gonna have you guys pay it. So it's really that story is really ironic, but it happens everywhere in the world, and it's happening right now in the World Cup. You have people just stuck with the bill at the end of the whole thing.
One final phone call. I hope I pronounce your name right. Sadi and Chino Hills.
Yes, that's me.
Okay, you have 45 seconds. Quickly, please.
Yes, I was just wondering, why did they have to build more stadiums? And even though if you have stadiums that used for the soccer, but actually it could be used for a lot of other things. I played soccer when I was 15. I'm 55 right now. Wow. I played for like 20 years. And I came from Lebanon. Lebanon is 150 miles long and 50 miles deep, and we had three stadiums.
Thanks for your call, Sadi. I'm sorry I have to cut off. I have to cut you guys off, too. Yeah. Jennifer, Fernando, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Gustavo.
I want to plug their podcast, The People's Game, thepeoplesgame.org. I want to thank Fernando and Jennifer. I want to thank my producer, Cassandra. I want to thank my engineer, G. I want to thank my Svengali, Alan Minsky, and 1.8milliondreams.com. And I am Gustavo Riano. Please go have fun and go Netherlands. Woo!
Esta situación me está llevando.